If we remember, Deuteronomy 12 related to command 1, no other gods before me. Deuteronomy 13, therefore, relates to command 2, which is no idols. Okay? And Deuteronomy 3 brings up three situations of what you do when you're tempted to idolatry. There are three different situations, but really, they all have the same response. Okay? They're all basically the same. So the first one, verses 1 to 5, are if there is a prophet or dreamer, or in other words, a religious leader, okay, that even through miracles says we should worship other gods. And we talked about how this puts Israel in a hard spot, because later on in Deuteronomy it says you better listen to the prophets. And if you don't listen to the prophets, God's going to hold you accountable, right? Because God is speaking through them, so you better do what they say. So now you have a powerful religious leader who has great authority, and he's telling you to go worship other gods. Okay, well, if he's going to say that, then you have to kill him. That's the commandment, okay, that you do not allow him to live. Okay, but like we said before, the religious leader is probably not going to be so blatant and blunt, you know. It might be covered, so you have to be very discerning. Okay, and then we turned into 1 John 4 in the New Testament says where we have to discern the spirits. Okay, we have to be very discerning in what we hear to know if someone is a false teacher or not. Okay?
Can you
yes.
When I wrote this down, mm-hmm. from my notes, it didn't make sense. The one right before 1 John, the Matthew 7.
Yes.
15 to 20, all I wrote was first fruits. And I was like, what is that?
I don't know. What does that mean? Let me look. I don't, because that's not, because this is Matthew 7:15-20. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. Oh, you will know them by their fruits. Maybe not first fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. And I talked about last time how, you know, how many pastors have eventually fallen to adultery or fraud or, you know, embezzlement, okay? So they might start off and you might not know, right? But eventually their fruits come out and you will know them by their fruits.
Well, that makes a lot more sense. You know when you're writing
yes,
like 10 miles an hour?
Yeah.
You can just know it makes sense.
Yeah, so this was another link in the New Testament to this same idea of we don't go around killing false prophets, though maybe that would be nice sometimes, but we are not a nation of Israel. Remember, Deuteronomy, these laws are specifically to how the nation of Israel was to live out the Ten Commandments. We are still supposed to live out that same creation theology, but it's going to look different. We're not going to go around and kill false prophets, okay, because the government will have something to say about that. But we still need to be discerning, and we need to make sure that we are not under their leadership, and then we need to make sure that we warn others that this is not a good person to follow. Okay. Good. Any other questions? All right. So the second scenario is in verse 6 through 11. So can someone read for me Deuteronomy 13, verse 6 through 11? Okay, so the second scenario is if it's a family or a friend, okay? And if you look at verses 6 and 7, well, really verse 6, these are the terms of greatest intimacy. I mean, like Moses, when he's building this case, is like, this is the person that is closest as possible to you, okay? Your brother, it says your brother, your mother's son. Remember at this time, men often had multiple wives, okay? But this is your brother from the same mother. So this would be like Joseph and Benjamin. And if you remember that whole story, Joseph treated Benjamin different than he did all his other brothers because they shared the same mother. Okay, so this is not just your brother, it's your closest brother, okay? Then it says, your son or your daughter, okay, obviously you're going to be close to your children, or the wife you cherish. That wife you cherish is literally wife of your bosom, okay? So the wife that you hold very close, that you love and cherish, the wife of your bosom, okay? Then it says, or your friend who is as your own soul. Think of David and Jonathan. Okay, that kind of friendship. So these are the people that are absolutely the closest people to you, okay, that you love the most. Okay, even these people can tempt you to go into idolatry. So it's these people who entice you, or one of these people who entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, and again, whom neither you nor your fathers have known. And we talked about that last week. This known is not just an intellectual knowledge, it's an experiential knowledge. So Israel only has experience with Yahweh. They don't have experience with these other gods. And then verse 7, of the gods of the people who are around you, near you, or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end. So these are the gods of the surrounding nations. Okay? And notice too, it says entice you secretly. Okay? So this is an intimate, close relationship. And so they can come to you and it's just a one-on-one conversation and nobody else knows about it, right? If it's a religious leader speaking up front, right, you can get together with your buddies and be like, yeah, is what he said, is that really right? You know, we don't really know. We think he's trying to get us to go after other gods. You have people to confer with, right? Because it's more public. It's out in the open. This is in the secret place. This is with your best friend. This is with the brother that you love. This is with your wife, okay? Where nobody else is going to know anything about it because it's secret and intimate. Only you know. Okay, that's what makes this one so hard. Verse 8. If you notice, the next couple verses, the emphasis is on you because you are the only one that knows about it. Right? You shall not yield to him or listen to him. So the first thing you have to do is you have to resist the temptation. When it's coming from somebody that you love and you trust, it's a far greater temptation than if it's coming from even a religious authority, even a powerful figure, right? Now, this is somebody that you love and trust. This could be your wife. This is your best friend. This is your brother, okay? This is your one of your kids. Okay, so first you cannot give in to temptation. Then what? Your eye shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him. Okay, so you can have no pity and you cannot hide him, hide the person. Okay, this is how extreme idolatry is, right? There is no mercy to be shown. It doesn't matter who the person is that's tempting you. You are to show no mercy, right? You are not to hide him. Verse 9, but you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death. Okay? So you have to bring the sin public, right? You have to be the tattletale and tell and bring it to light because it's that serious. This is not something that you can just sweep under the rug and ignore. Okay, you have to be the one that carry out the execution. You have to throw the first stone because this person now is dying on your testimony. Okay, then it says, end of verse 9, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So everybody, the community is to join in because the community as a whole is to condemn idolatry, but you're the one that has to throw the first stone. And we know it's stoning because verse 10, so you shall stone him to death. Okay. So verse 9, your hand shall be first against him. So that means you would throw the first stone. Okay. This is how much you have to love God and hate idolatry. Okay. Let's go to Matthew 18. Can someone read for me Matthew 18, verse 8 through 9? Yeah, Matthew 18, verses 8 and 9.
If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to two hands or 2 feet and be cast into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life than to have two eyes and be cast into the fire.
Okay, so this same extreme action against idolatry, right, from the Old Testament is carried into the New Testament, but now we're not killing others, right? We are to kill sin in ourselves. So the same kind of language that is used in Deuteronomy 13, I mean, that's Hebrew, this is Greek, but that same idea, the same extreme, like you wipe it out from among you, it's used of ourselves for our own sin, right? As New Testament believers, we're not going to go around killing people, okay? Because that's not the society we live in anymore. And the Christians, we are not a nation anymore, okay? So there are differences, okay? But we are to take that extremism and apply it to sin in our own life, right? Where we chop off our hand and cut out our eye. Now, I know it doesn't literally mean that, but it's you go to extreme measures to remove the sin from your own life, okay? Back to Deuteronomy 13, verse 11. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid and will never again do such a wicked thing among you, right? This would be quite extreme. This would be quite an extreme example. If a husband drags out his wife or a father drags out his son, you know, or a friend drags out his best friend and is actually the one that has to throw the first stone to put him to death. I mean, that's a pretty extreme example. And it will be an example and a lesson, right? So that no one else would do it. Well, we know that's not going to probably be true. And who knows if they followed this law, right? Like we've said, these are the laws, how Israel was supposed to act, whether they did or not is up for debate, right, in some of these things. But this was the idea. It was supposed to be such an extreme deterrent that no one else would be tempted to do this, to abandon God. All right. Any questions? Verses 6 through 11. All right. The last example is verse 12 to 18. And this is if an entire city goes apostate. Okay. So can someone read for me verses 12 through 18?
If you hear it said about one of your cities, the Lord your God has given you to live in, that wicked men have sprung up among you, let the inhabitants of their city astray and say, let's go and worship other gods, which you have not known. You are to inquire, investigate, and interrogate thoroughly. If the report turns out to be true that this detestable act has been done among you, you must strike down the inhabitants of that city with a sword. Completely destroy everyone in it, as well as the livestock, with the sword. You are to gather all its spoil in the middle of the city square and completely burn the city and all its spoil for the Lord your God. The city is to remain a mound of ruins forever. It is not to be rebuilt. Nothing set apart for destruction is to remain in your land, so that the Lord will turn from his burning anger and grant you mercy, show you compassion, and multiply you as he swore to your ancestors. This will occur if you obey the Lord your God, keeping all his commands I am giving you today, doing what is right in the sight of the Lord your God.
Okay, so this is larger scale apostasy than heretofore has been discussed. Okay, an entire city is convinced to serve other gods. Okay, so verse 12, if you hear in one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you. So the emphasis is, this is a slap in the face to God, that you are even in this city is a gift from God. And now this whole city has turned away from God to serve other gods, again, that they do not know. Okay, so if you hear in one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men, that word worthless men literally in the Hebrew is men, the sons of Belial. Okay, Belial is another name for Satan. Okay, so these are evil men. These men are wicked and very persuasive. They're very good at what they do because they have convinced an entire city, right? Some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods. And again, whom you have not known. So in every case, Moses emphasizes, you Israel, you know one God. There are no other gods that you know. You are not to serve any other gods. Okay? Verse 14. Then you shall investigate, search out, and inquire thoroughly. Okay, because the punishment is so great, because basically you raise the city to the ground and kill everybody in it, you got to make sure that it's true. Okay, so you're going to go in and you're going to investigate and you're going to ask questions and you're going to figure out whether this is true or not, if the whole city has abandoned God and gone to serve other gods. Okay, if it is true and the matter established that this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike down the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that is in it. Okay, so the entire city, all the inhabitants and all the stuff is destroyed, basically everything. You don't get to keep the cattle. You don't get to keep any of the gold or the valuable things in it. Everybody dies and all the animals die and all the stuff is burned to God as a whole burnt offering. Okay, everything in the city has been defiled by the worship of other gods and none of it can be saved. You're not allowed to take any of it. Okay. End of verse 16, it says, it shall be a ruin forever. It shall never be rebuilt. Okay, so if this happens, you're to totally destroy the city and then no one else can ever live there ever again. Okay, it is to be a lasting and enduring example of the consequences of idolatry. This is what happens if you abandon Yahweh and go and serve other gods. The purpose, verse 17, nothing from that which is put under the ban shall cling to your hand in order that the Lord may turn from his burning anger and show mercy on you and have compassion on you. Okay, so the purpose of all this is to avert the anger of God and bring back his mercy and compassion. If Israel listens and does this, they will increase, right? It says, compassion on you and make you increase, just as he has sworn to your fathers. If you listen to the voice of the Lord your God, keeping all his commandments, which I'm commanding you today, and doing what is right in the sight of the Lord your God. So if they obey, if they treat idolatry this way, right, then they will flourish and they will increase. Okay. So idolatry is of the utmost seriousness, right? And only radical action can stop it. God demands he is worshipped and he is worshipped alone. He gets to dictate how he is worshipped, right? And that he is worshipped alone. So idolatry is not casual. This is not just a, oh, we get to have God and this other God on the side, okay? God says no. If there is any temptation, this is how you deal with it. Basically, you kill him. You wipe him out because you have to remove the sin from among you, okay? In the New Testament, Matthew 18 goes through the steps of church discipline, right? And the point of church discipline is that we as a church remove the sin from among us. Because if sin is tolerated in the church, right, it's just going to spread. Sin never stays isolated. We all think it does. You know, oh, if I do this, it will just affect me. No, that's never the truth. Okay, that's the deceitfulness of sin. Okay, sin always spreads. And so if there is sin in the church, it has to be dealt with. And when it is not, it spreads and affects the whole church. And you see that in 1 Corinthians, right? 1 Corinthians 5, when they have the man who has his father's wife, right? And the Corinthian church is like, oh, we're proud of this. Look how tolerant we are. You know, we accept anybody. And Paul's like, no. He's like, if I were there, that guy would already be out on his left ear. You know, he'd be out. I would have given him over to Satan already. Okay, because if he is claiming to be a believer and he is living in blatant sin, you, Corinthian church, are not to allow this. You have to confront it. You cannot allow that kind of sin to just be in your church. Okay, so in the New Testament, we don't go around burning cities or killing false prophets or killing family members, okay? But that same type of language is used in the New Testament to deal with sin, okay? And we are not allowed to just let sin fester and go unconfronted, okay? Especially in the church. Questions?
You know, people that don't understand, you know, and I don't know, you know, it's hard to explain. It's like, you know, that's what the Bible teaches. Well, that's
that can't be right, because God is a God of love. You know, they go that whole trip. But there's so many churches who tolerate it.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's why they're so messed up.
Yep. Well, and the thing is, by the time it gets to the point where the pastor or the elder is announcing it from the front, like, it's been through a long process. It's right. It's not like, oop, we found out Julie did this, you know, yesterday. You know, that's not how it works.
I think the interesting thing is the process is not just to kick them out. The process is to continue to restore them.
Right.
And what is interesting to me is I've seen that happen once in our church in California. And Kenny was on the elder board, and the lady came back and wanted to be restored. And they all looked at each other and said, we don't even know how to do that. We've never had anybody ever come back and ask to do that. So then you got to go through and you do the process. And it took 6 to 8 months for that to happen.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean, it's a process, and people have to get involved, but it's not just, you know, you're out.
Right.
What you did.
Right.
You
know,
they choose, all be out. But most of the time, a lot of times, you're saying they choose to stay out.
If they've gotten that far to be kicked out, then yeah, they don't come back.
And they're just living, they're just enjoying their sin and don't come
back. Right.
Well, they just think that they're okay.
Or they just go find another church that'll take them.
And that happens more than you know.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because most churches don't.
Well, and they don't check. You know, I mean, it happened to our youth pastor that our oldest was under, and they had to remove him from the church, and he went off to another church and they hired him, you know, without checking or, you know, hearing. And that just brings complete sin into a body.
Mm-hmm.
And then all kinds of other stuff starts to happen. I just don't get it. I don't get it how plain it is, and churches
right.
will not do it.
Right. It's so plain, and they're like, but we don't have to do that.
Because it airs their dirty laundry in front of people. And you can do it in a...
Or maybe not just, they're not going to do it because it airs dirty laundry. They're not going to do it because...
Against the truth.
We're just going to emphasize, you know, God's forgiving. And
right.
Something that just irritates me. Can you tell?
But the thing is, if you do church discipline, right, I mean, it starts with one person, which is supposed to be just the lay people, just us, right, confronting another person. And a lot of times, that's where it ends. And so nobody else even finds out about it, because it's one person confronting another person, that person repents, and it's done and over with. It's only if you're stubborn in your sin that then you get a second person, and then eventually it comes to the church. So the church elders shouldn't even know about most of it, because it should just stop with one-on-one, and then just the two of you, and then that's not a big deal. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Any other questions or comments?
Where he can burn the whole city. And brings back to mind Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah. Yeah. God just decimated the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah. Burns it to the ground.
Are there any examples that you know of a city of that happening, you know, after this point?
No. I mean, not that I know. I can ask Kyle, but right after they've
got,
I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah, no, we know they didn't. I mean, during the time of the kings, basically then, if this is to be followed, all of Israel should have been burned to the ground. I mean, so, well, especially in the north, right? I mean, the north just totally abandoned God. So, good. Any other questions or comments? All right, Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 14, verses 1 to 21 are going to deal with command 3. Okay, command 3 is don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Okay, in this command, it's specifically referring to an oath situation, okay, where you know, I swear by Yahweh that I will do or not do blah, 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 or in court or whatever, that kind of situation, okay? And the idea behind it is God is your highest accountability, Okay? So if you don't do it, you are offering yourself up to God for judgment. Okay? And if you don't do what you say, then in essence, your actions are saying that you don't really believe God is that mighty and that he can really do anything about it. Okay? You're not too afraid of any consequences of God smiting you because you didn't keep your word. Okay? So now we're going to talk about laws about food. So, we'll get there. How that ties into don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Okay, so can someone read for me verses 1 to 21?
You are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave your forehead for the sake of the dead. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. You shall not eat any detestable thing. These are the animals which you may eat: the ox, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roebuck, the wild goat, the ibex, the antelope, and the mountain sheep, and any animal that divides the hoof and has the hoof split in two and chews the cud among the animals that you may eat. Nevertheless, you are not to eat of these among those which chew the cud, or among those who divide the hoof in two, the camel and the rabbit and the rock badger. For those who chew the cud, they do not divide the hoof, they are unclean to you. And the pig, because it divides the hoof, but does not chew the cud, it is unclean to you. You shall not eat any of their flesh, nor touch their carcasses. These you may eat of all that are in the water. Anything that has fins and scales you may eat, but anything that does not have fins and scales you shall not eat, it is unclean to you. You may eat any clean bird, but these are the ones which you shall not eat: the eagle and the vulture and the buzzard and the red kite and the falcon and the kite and their kind, and every raven and its kind, and the ostrich and the owl, the seagull and the hawk and their kind, the little owl and the great owl, the white owl, the pelican and the carrion, the vulture, the cormorant, the stork and the heron and their in their kind, and the hoopoe and the bat. And all the seeming like its wings are unclean to you, they shall not be eaten. You shall eat any clean bird. You shall not eat anything that dies of itself. You may give it to the alien who is in your town, so that he may eat it, and you may sell it to a foreigner, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk.
All right. Okay, so don't take the Lord, your name of the Lord your God in vain, and here are your dietary laws. Okay, so verse 1 and 2 is not the dietary law, but this deals with how Israel is to mourn, okay? And it starts out, you are the sons of the Lord your God. So Israel is God's son, okay? So they have to accurately represent God. And remember when we discussed don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, we talked about how name means more than just your title. It is the essence of who you are. Okay? So don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You have to represent God accurately for who he actually is. And that too you have to do if you are a son, right? You know, if you have a son or a daughter, right? You want them to represent your family accurately. So Israel is to represent God. They're his son. So how are they going to do that? They are not allowed to mourn like the nations mourn. Okay. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave your forehead for the sake of the dead. Israel is to be different because their God is different than any other God. Okay. This is not the first time this has been said. If we go back to Leviticus, I'll read it quickly. Leviticus 19. Verse 28, Leviticus 19, verse 28 says, you shall not make any cuts in your body for the dead, nor make any tattoo marks on yourself. I am the Lord. Okay? So apparently this was a custom of the time when somebody died to show your mourning, to show your sadness, you cut yourself. Okay? Also, whatever it means by shaving your forehead. We're not exactly sure what that meant. Okay? If men just shave, well, we don't know. Okay, but whatever it was an act that the nations did to mourn the dead. And God says, no, this is This is not how you are to mourn for the dead. Okay. Why? Because you are serving a different God. You are my sons and I am different. Okay. Also, 1 Kings 18:28, we're not going to turn there, but that's when that's Elisha, the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, right? And the prophets of Baal are trying to get Baal to send fire down to burn the sacrifice, right? And one of the things they do is they cut themselves, okay? So maybe cutting had some magical God-summoning power, you know? They were doing it to try to attract Baal's attention. So they believed at least that it did something to get his attention, right? And then Elijah just stands back and mocks him and says, you know, maybe Baal's in the bathroom or on a trip. Okay, can't hear you. Shout louder. Okay, but regardless, Israel is to have no part in any of these pagan practices, okay? They are to proclaim God's name and his holiness, right? Verse 2, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. So God reminds them, you are separate. You are different. I specifically picked you. You have to act different. One of the ways you're going to do that is you don't get to do these customs that the pagans do. Okay. Then we get into the main section. Verse 3 to 21, these are dietary laws. Verse 3 just basically sums it all up. You shall not eat any detestable thing. Okay, that word detestable, it is used for any practice that is unacceptable to God. So it's not just about food you eat, but anything that the pagans do that is unacceptable to God is detestable. Okay, now, the third command, don't take God's name in vain, is explicitly expressed in Israel, in that nation, that as a nation as a whole was to point to God through what Israel eats. How were they going to proclaim to the nations God's character and how God is different than all the other nations? It was going to be in the practical way of what they ate, but primarily what they didn't eat. Okay, so that's how they were going to proclaim God's name to the nations. Okay, to show that our God, his character, it's different than your gods. Okay, his essence is different than the nature of your gods. How do we know that? Huh. The Israelites, they don't eat pigs. I wonder why. Okay, or they don't eat whatever, any of these other animals that you're not supposed to eat. Okay. So we'll get into this. These laws are designed to exclude certain types of animals. Okay. And these are guidelines. Some of the birds are pretty specific about what you can eat. But this is not to be a comprehensive list of yes, you can eat these and no, you cannot eat these. It's supposed to give some guidelines. So if you run across an animal, you're not sure what it is, you can kind of apply these rules and figure out if you're allowed to eat it or not. Okay. Okay. Generally speaking, these rules say Israel, you are not to eat animals that in that culture were considered dirty, yucky, gross. Okay? So the animals that in the ancient Near East were considered gross or unhygienic, whether they really are or not, right, is beside the point. This is culture. In that culture, these animals that God says, Israel, you are not allowed to eat, they thought were gross and yucky and dirty. Okay, so God says you're not allowed to eat the animals that the nations all think are gross and dirty, because if you do, it says something about me, about God. So God is to be represented by Israel all the way down to their daily meals. Okay, I mean, that's how minute we're getting. Okay, but if you eat a gross, dirty animal, culturally speaking, right, then the nations will think, oh, God doesn't care about that. Okay, so maybe he's okay with them being a little gross and dirty and yucky. Okay, and God's saying, no, I do care. You are to be a holy nation. You are to be a nation of priests. You are to be set apart. So you are not to eat these culturally dirty foods. Okay, notice the terms that are used are clean and unclean, right? Verse 11, you may eat any clean bird. Verse 10, just before it, right? If it does not have fins or scales, you shall not eat. It is unclean for you. Okay, the terms are not good and evil. Right? This is clean and unclean. It's not good and evil, because all creatures are what? Good. God proclaimed that all of the animals that he made are good in creation, right? And so then that's why when we get to the New Testament, right, and he lowers down the sheet, right, and Peter says, oh, I've never eaten anything unclean. And God says, don't you say what's unclean, what I have proclaimed clean, right? Because all animals are good, okay? And now, and I mean, and that example was to show Peter, right, that the Gentiles are now welcome into the church. So we're getting rid of old cultural ideas and we're moving forward in redemptive history. Okay, so clean and unclean, not good and evil. Clean and unclean here refers to the cultural perception of hygienic and unhygienic. Okay, and I read commentaries. There have been studies done, you know, whether these animals really have more diseases or toxins, whatever, whatever. Okay, and maybe some of them do. So maybe some of them aren't as hygienic, right, as others. But the idea here is this was culturally perceived. Okay, these are dirty animals, and those are not dirty animals. Okay. Also, these same words of clean and unclean we've seen all throughout Leviticus, right? Of being ceremonially clean and unclean. And that was how Israel was to present themselves to God, right? They had to be a certain level of cleanliness, right? They would have to bathe and wash to wash away their uncleanness to enter the sanctuary of God. And so then in their what they eat as well, they have to then only eat what is clean and culturally viewed as hygienic, to show that this is their God cares even down to this level of my life, what I put in my body, what I eat and what I don't eat. Okay? So it would proclaim to the rest of the world something about God. Okay? Okay. So verse 4. These are the animals which you may eat: the ox, sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roebuck, the wild goat, the ibex, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. Okay. The animals that are discussed in the three spheres of creation. We have land animals in verses 3 through 8. Sea animals, water animals in verses 9 and 10, and animals that live in the sky, in the air, in verses 11 through 20. Okay, so we're dealing with the three spheres of creation. First is the land animals. Okay, and no, many of these animals are very difficult to translate into English. A lot of these animals, you're going to have little numbers by them, and they're going to have other ideas, or basically saying, we don't know what this animal is, right? Because this animal in the Hebrew probably appears here and nowhere else, you know, and it's really hard to translate to know what it is, okay? So we're not going to be so specific about which of the animals these specific animals are, because that's not really the important idea, okay? The idea behind it is the animals they're allowed to eat are clean and hygienic in the view of the culture of that time, and the animals that they're not allowed to eat are dirty, gross animals in the view of that time, okay? So verse 4 through 5, God lists clean land animals, but this is not necessarily a complete list. And then in verse 6, he gives the principle. Any animal that divides the hoof and has the hoof split in two and chews the cud among the animals that you meet. So this is the general rule. If you run into a land animal and you don't know what it is, it has to have a hoof, right? And it has to chew the cud. If it doesn't fall into both of those categories, you're not allowed to eat it. Okay, so that's the general rule that will cover any land animal, you know, that you meet, and maybe you don't know what it is. Okay, okay. Then it gives, you know, ones that have that chew the cud but don't have a split hoof, right? The camel, the rabbit, the chaffon. Though they chew the cud, they don't divide the hoof. Okay, so those are unclean. And then the pig is the main one. I believe it might be the only one that has a split hoof but doesn't chew the cud. Okay. This is interesting. In the ancient Near East, there was a general consensus. Pigs were gross and dirty. They were yucky. They lived in the mud and the filth, right? They're gross. But they were convenient. They were easy to raise, right? I mean, what do? They just lie around. You just feed them food, okay? And then they grow big and fat, and then you kill them, and then you eat them, and they taste delicious, okay? So they thought they were gross. So all of them thought they were gross, okay? But because they're easy and they're convenient, all the nations ate them anyway, even though there was a general consensus that this animal is a gross animal, a dirty animal, okay? Now, we do know that this at least is one rule Israel did follow, because in archaeology, when they're digging up a place, they know it is an Israelite location if there are no pig bones there. And they know that it's a Canaanite location if they find pig bones. Okay? So it was, pigs were eaten that commonly that there would, if it was a Canaanite location, there's pig bones, and if there's not, then it's a Jewish site. Okay, so we do know they obeyed this rule. Okay. Verse 9 and 10, these are the rules for the sea animals, and notice there's no specific examples listed here. Abby, I think you've had enough. So these you may eat of all that are in the water, anything that has fins and scales. So basically a normal fish. You're allowed to eat all fish. Okay, but anything that does not have fins and scales, you shall not eat. So this is like a catfish, an eel, a ray, shrimp, right? And these animals tend to be bottom feeders. They're slithering down in the bottom of the ocean amongst the mud and the muck. Okay, so they are viewed to be dirty and unclean, whereas the fish, they swim up in the sea, you know, and so then they're clean. Okay, so the ones that were at the bottom are viewed as gross and dirty, right? And so Israel was not to eat those. Okay, then verses 11 through 20, these are birds, okay, or animals of the air, okay? Verse 11, it just says you can eat any clean bird, and then it goes on to list all the ones you can't eat. Again, some of these are really hard to translate, so we don't have to take it. I mean, you could go through and research each of these kinds, okay? But the general idea is the ones that they are not to eat are birds that eat dead things, carrion birds, vultures, okay? Or they eat dead things, okay? Now, I don't know if an ostrich does, but okay, but that's the idea. God is a God who's associated with life. Okay, not death. So you don't eat animals that would culturally indicate otherwise, because scavenger birds are associated with death. They have to wait for something to die, and then they go and they eat it. So you don't eat the vulture, because that eats something that's dead. And God is a God of life. He's not a God of death. So you don't eat that bird. Okay? I mean, yes, because it's the ox, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roebuck, wild goat, ibex, antelope. Yeah, you don't have any. I mean, even today, we don't eat carnivores. I mean, I guess a chicken can technically eat whatever, right? But typically, chickens eat. I mean, I think you put anything before chicken, it'll eat it. But they typically just eat bugs. And pigs also eat anything. Anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pigs will eat anything. But yeah, no, they'll eat anything. Yeah.
I read a nasty book,
pigs?
Anyway, the bad guys, you know, would, if they wanted to get rid of a body, they'd take it to a pig farm and throw it in the pig, and by my morning it was gone.
Yep. Oh.
Wow, never knew that. I've never eaten another pig. Honey, I'm sorry you like to smoke ribs because I'm done.
All right. Okay, then verse 21. You shall not eat anything which dies of itself. You may give it to the alien who's in your town so that he may eat it, or you may sell it to the foreigner, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. So these are two final laws. The first part is most likely because if an animal dies of itself, it has not been slaughtered in the correct way, and so the blood has not had a chance to drain properly, right? And if you remember in chapter 12, you know, it was, you're to sacrifice to the Lord, but you got, oh, yep. You can eat meat in your towns if you want to, right? If you're too far away from the place God chooses, but you have to make sure to drain the blood. You cannot eat the blood. Okay, so if an animal dies by itself, the blood's not been drained properly, don't eat it, but you don't just have to toss it, right, on the compost pile. you can sell it to the alien, the resident foreigner, or, you know, some traveling foreigners through, okay? Because they don't have the same restrictions, so you can still get money off of it if you want to, but you are not to eat it. Why? For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. So everything you do, Israel, down to the what you eat and don't eat, reflects the name of God, who God is, what his character is, what he cares about. Okay, then don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. If you remember, we talked about this all the way back in Exodus. Okay, this was likely a Canaanite fertility practice where they would, you know, because the baby drinks the mother's milk, so now you have the source of life for the kid and it's the means of death for the kid, and somehow that's going to give you better crops. Who knows? Okay, but it was probably a fertility practice. God says don't do it. And this is where we get kosher from, okay? This verse and the verse in Exodus where it says, don't do this. And so now you can't mix any milk and meat because for fear that maybe it's the milk from the mother of the meat that you are eating, okay? So that's why you never have dairy and meat together in kosher. And to the point where you have two sets of dishes, okay? And two parts of your kitchen, one where you deal with dairy and one where you deal with meat, because heaven forbid you have one speck of dairy ever mixed with one speck of meat. Okay. So kosher dairy, your breakfast meal is your dairy meal, okay, where you can have your milk and your yogurt and your cheese, and then lunch and supper are your meat meals.
Hmm. So. Where Misha and Kyle went to school at Ibex, in that place,
they were kosher.
They were kosher. They had that in there.
Yes. And so then you have different dishes for breakfast than you do for lunch and supper. Anyways, I think that might be a little extreme from this verse, but.
And then is it before Passover you have to get rid of all the leaven?
Yes.
You have to go around and get every crumb.
Yes, they would do a big scream.
Bread or cracker, any crumb.
Yeah.
Prepare food in a kitchen with even a breadcrumb on the floor.
Yeah.
There you go. Where's your pickles come from? Kosher pickles. That's interesting.
Wait, I'm sorry, what? Yeah, it just means it's been prepared in a kosher facility, so there's no milk, and it's been blessed by a rabbi. That's what kosher means. And kosher will be on a lot of things. You'll see the little K on a lot of different food items. And it just means that it's been prepared in a kosher place where, I mean, dill pickles doesn't have dairy or meat in it. So, but it's in a, been prepared in a place that doesn't ever mix the two, and it's been then been blessed by a rabbi. I don't know if each jar is blessed or like just the facility is blessed by a rabbi and then that's good enough.
Can I tell you a story about that?
What did you say?
A rabbi paid a ton of money when he gets called and he goes to the place and just kind of
blesses it.
Oh, maybe that was Tom's story. I don't know. But somebody's got a story about that.
I'm sure
about
how they're
retained.
Yeah.
No, he just kind of stands at the facility and blesses it.
Yeah. Anyways, all right, questions, verse 1 to 21. Okay. Yes.
No, never mind. I'm good.
Oh, okay. Good. Anything else? I like those kind of questions. All right. And we will be done early today because I only have through the end of 14 prepared. But. Verse 22, so 14:22 all the way through chapter 16, verse 17, this is all going to relate to command 4, which is keep the Sabbath. Okay? Keep the Sabbath. The idea behind that is God is in charge of your time. Okay? He has lordship over all time and all creation, right? Because by the time we get to Sabbath and creation week, right, everything's been created. Okay, so God is in control of all of it, and he gets to dictate when you do what you do and how you do it. Okay, so that's why it says you work for, you know, 6 days, and then on the seventh day you rest. Okay, so God is in charge of your time. You don't get to just do whatever you want, whenever you want. God's going to tell you what to do and when to do it. And now it's also going to extend to your stuff because he is God of all creation. You only have anything, Israel, because God gave it to you. So he gets to tell you what to do with your stuff. So here, verse 22, all the way through chapter 16, verse 17, is going to deal with what Israel has to do with their stuff. how they have to give part of it away and what they're supposed to do with it, and then also their festivals and celebrations. Okay, because God is not going to just dictate that on a weekly basis you rest one day, right? He's also going to dictate when you have your celebrations and what you do. Why? Because God is Lord. He is sovereign over your time and all your stuff. Okay, God owns it all. So can someone read for me verses 22 to 29?
You may spend the money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink or whatever your heart desires, and there you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice you and your household. Also you shall not neglect the Levite who is in your town, for he has no portion or inheritance among you. At the end of every third year you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in that year and shall deposit it in your town. The Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, and the widow who are in your town shall come and eat and be satisfied in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands that you do.
Okay, so the first issue that's dealt with under Sabbath is tithe. This is 10% of all the produce of your field. Okay, this is what you give to God, because really all of it belongs to God. Okay, so to acknowledge that the only reason that you have a harvest in the first place, the only reason that you have anything is because God gave it to you, you give back 10% to God. Okay? The tithe is also talked about in Leviticus 27 and in Numbers 18. Okay? Numbers says that the tithe belongs primarily to the Levites. This is how they live. They get the tithe, right? And then the Levites then have to do a tithe of the tithe, so 10% of the 10%, and that goes to the priests, okay? That's what Numbers 18, 21 to 32 says, okay? This gives us new regulations, right? Of your tithe, you are to bring a portion of it to Jerusalem, well, the place that God chooses. They don't know yet it's going to be Jerusalem, but it's going to be Jerusalem, right? And you're to have a fellowship meal before God. This is a fellowship offering, a celebratory meal before God every year, okay, to say, God, you've given me everything, and here we are to celebrate what we have. Okay? Here it includes verse 23, you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God at the place where he chooses to establish his name, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, and the firstborn of the herd in your flock. Okay, so this includes animals as well, because the firstborn belong to God. Okay, and if it was a firstborn of a clean animal, right, then they could bring it and give it as a sacrifice to God. And then they would be able to then eat part of it with their, it says, where does it say? End of verse 26, there you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice you and your household. Okay, so this is a family affair, right, where you go down and you celebrate before God as a reminder that he has given you everything that you have. Okay, back to verse 23, you bring the firstborn of your flock and everything, and then it says at the end, so that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. This is the purpose. It's a yearly reminder. God owns it all. The only reason I have anything is because God gave it to me. Right, I need to keep my eyes on him, not forget. I need to always remember him and remember that he is sovereign over all. Okay. Israel is absolutely dependent on God. Okay, they have nothing without him. Okay, verse 24 to 27 then is the practical law. Basically, it's saying if you live too far away where it's going to be too much work to drive your animals all the way from Galilee down to Jerusalem, right, and all the your grain and stuff for this meal, if that's going to be too hard to do, it's too far of a distance, God allows you to sell it, You sell it, and then you take the money, and you take it to Jerusalem, and then in Jerusalem, you can buy whatever you want for this fellowship offering, for this celebratory meal. Okay? At the end of verse 26 again, you are to rejoice with your household. Verse 27, also you shall not neglect the Levite who is in your town, for he has no portion or inheritance among you. Okay, so this was to be a joyful meal shared with the whole family, and you had to make sure that you remembered the Levites, that you included them as well. They are the main beneficiaries of the tithe, right, because they receive no inheritance. So this is how they make their living. Okay. Verse 28 and 29, at the end of every third year, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in that year and shall deposit it in your town. The Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, and the widow who are in your town shall come and eat and be satisfied in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. Okay, it says every third year. Okay, in Israel, there are going to be 7-year cycles. If you look at 15 verse 1, it says at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a remission. Okay, so there are 7-year cycle. And if you remember, after you have 7 sevens, right, 49 years, then in the 50th year, we get the year of Jubilee. So every 7th year was supposed to be a Sabbath year where you didn't work. And then every 50th year was like all everybody goes free. All debts are totally canceled, etc. Year of Jubilee. We don't know that they ever really did the year of Jubilee. We don't even know if they did year 7 Sabbath years, okay? But regardless, so when it says every third year, this is year 3 and year 6 of the 7-year cycle. And the third year and the 6th year, okay, of the 7-year cycle. The tithe was to be set aside in a special pot. And this was then to be distributed, one, among the Levites, but then also the alien, the orphan, and the widow. These are people, Levites, aliens, orphans, widows, who don't own any land, who can't produce produce by themselves. Okay, they can't grow food. They don't own property. All of Israel was to depend on God. Okay? No, they're not. They're in the land now. All these laws assume that they are in Canaan. Okay. Yep, yep. And so that's why you don't get some of these laws in like Leviticus or Numbers, right? Because they're still in the desert. They don't apply. But then now this Deuteronomy, as soon as Deuteronomy's done and Moses goes up the mountain and dies, they cross the Jordan River into Canaan. And then they start Joshua and they start conquering the land. So these laws are applicable to when they're in the land. And then that's why it says, verse 24, if the distance is so great that you're not able to bring the tithe, since the place, you know, if you're living way up in Galilee and Jerusalem's way down south, right, that might be too far to...
But if he takes that money and goes to Jerusalem anyway, why couldn't he have taken that?
Well, because it's a lot more work to drag along a 1-year-old oxen and all this food, right, than to just have a pile of coins. You're going to have to walk it anyways, but to drag around a bunch of animals and stuff, it's going
to
be harder.
You have to take all the food for them for the whatever days the journey.
Right, right.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of hay and...
Yes. Right, because they had to walk. Which, Israel is not that big.
Walking from Galilee to Jerusalem.
Right, walking, especially with, you're supposed to go with your family. Right now, all this stuff, you know, maybe it's just a better idea to sell it, have the money, and then when you're in Jerusalem, then buy it. You know, it's just easier. So God allows for that.
I don't
know, something. It's not super far, but to walk it, and it's hilly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That is a great question. Oh, somebody who wants it. I mean, because they can, I mean, I'm sure they're, you could just sell it in the market. Everybody's going to buy food or. Right. Yes, and there were, that, I mean, and that's why, you know, it says if you find something dead, you can sell it to the alien or the foreigner, you know, because there are other people in the land too, but.
For a day and head to the border.
That's a great question if they all went at the same time. I would be inclined to say yes, but I don't know that for sure. But they would have had to leave some people behind because you can't just leave your towns empty and your fields with no one to watch over them. So I don't know.
You have your barley harvest and your wheat harvest.
Yeah, you had different harvest. Right.
So did you go like once for all with all three harvests, or did you go three times?
This sounds like you just go. Well, it says, you shall surely tithe all the produce from what you sow, which comes out of the field every year. So that's going to be a tithe of everything, all the harvest, right? But you shall eat in the presence of your, at the place where he chooses, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil. So I don't know if then they were a staggered, then some ate, then now and later, I don't know. Actually, whether they did this at all, I don't know that either. Good questions. I don't know how all the logistics worked out. Okay. But anyways, every third year, so the third year and the sixth year of the seventh year cycle, they set their tithe aside, and it was to provide for those who didn't. We're going to see throughout the laws, there are different ways to take care of those who didn't have property. I mean, one of them is going to be you don't harvest the edges of your field, right? You harvest the middle, and you let the poor and the orphan and the widow come, and this is what Ruth does, right? Gather up the edge, you know, and Boaz says, purposefully drop stuff for her, you know, but that's how they were to be provided for. So God makes sure that all those in his society are provided for. And this is to be a reminder to everybody, those who are wealthy enough and have your own land, right? Everything you have comes from God. The orphan and the widow, they can see that everything they have comes from God because they are reliant on the Israelites obeying these laws for them to survive. So the idea behind this tithe is God owns it all. He owns your time. He gets to tell you when to go and where. Okay. And he owns all your stuff. You think it's yours. It's not. God's going to tell you how much of it you got to be generous with. Okay. Because God owns all of it anyway.